This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Derek Book spent the first 20 years of his life in what he describes as substantial crisis. He was homeless and on the streets at 15 years of age, and went on to spend 5 years in and out of shelters in both Ontario and British Columbia. But Derek found his way out of homelessness and crisis. He went on to become university educated, and he's been working in the field of social work as a case planner, needle exchange worker, homeless count coordinator, and shelter coordinator. Derek Book is the author of an online blog called Formerly Homeless, and he's a tireless advocate for those experiencing homelessness. I spoke with Derek earlier this week.
You were born into what you describe as a multi-generationally broken Métis family in Ontario. How did your childhood, your family situation, lead to your homelessness?
I grew up in a family that we moved around a lot. We probably moved every couple of months. My mother had some really heavy trauma issues, mental health issues that she was dealing with. And, so it caused a lot of disruption in the family. Disruption became the norm. By the time I was 15 years old, the idea of leaving the home was not a big deal in the family, within the family cultural context. So I think what I grew up in, we didn't see home in the same way that other people see home.
You wrote that you were on the streets at age 15. What was that like?
Pretty awful. And I was on the street from 15 to about 20 off and on. I got involved in some programs here and there. In fact, I actually was in supportive housing for a couple of months as well, but nothing was really sticking and I was quite lost. I didn't really know what I was trying to do. Didn't have any supports or family or places where I could go. So I traveled around a lot. I was quite a transient homeless person. I would go from, Ontario to Calgary to Kelowna, BC to Vancouver. I sort of had this circuit of places that I would go to and stay in the shelters, sometimes outside. There were very brutal, brutal times out there, when I was alone, lying there on a piece of cardboard in the parkade, not a great feeling at 16 or 17 or whatever. And mostly my problem was with the people around me that were, just walking by or just didn't seem to care. It took me a long time to deal with that, those emotional feelings around that. Yeah, it was quite a difficult time. It seems like a very distant memory because we're going back to 1985 to 1990. It's sort of a long time ago, but some of the things I feel like they were yesterday.
Your recovery seemed to have occurred in stages. It was a process. It began with the impact, as you've written, of the Native Friendship Center and one particular outreach worker. Tell us more about how you exited homelessness and addiction, for that matter.
Anybody who's been through recovery can say this. They can look back and they can say there was that teacher in the third grade. In fact, I think all of us can point to those people in our lives that made those impacts. I think sometimes people don't realize when they're going through the world in a way that trying to be helpful, that they're having impact that they don't even realize they're having. And this guy, this counselor that I mentioned in the piece from the Friendship Center, he was just an outreach worker. I don't even remember the guy's name, which is really, embarrassing because a lot of the dialogue that we had set the path for how I was going to think in the future. And, I was just about to turn 20 or something like that around that time. So it was just before I finally got off the street for good. He was just going through his day. And I think those that are helping others don't realize sometimes the impact and the changes that they're making that are really incredibly positive. I wish I could find that guy and tell him. But I think, yes, recovery does happen in stages, and it happens through some inspiration as well. You find those people, and they just get you to that next level of understanding.
You specifically mention the Victoria Life Enrichment Society, and you describe it as being progressive and evidence-based. Tell us more about that experience.
That was a really big one. So that happened when I was around 25. I got off the street when I was 20. And I worked in the trades for a couple of years. And different dead-end jobs. And then I went into this treatment center, and I decided I was just going to quit everything and deal with my addiction. You know, it wasn't really an addiction thing for me. That wasn't the biggest focus in my life. It was more emotional. It was more about the abuse that I had suffered as a child and just, you know, the wreckage from the past. But the treatment center environment allowed me to explore that. And this treatment center was, you know, most of these people were master's level, client-centered, you know, kind of Rogerian, existential counseling, kind of choice-based. It wasn't solution-focused. It wasn't looking for outcomes. It wasn't behaviorism or cognitive therapy. It wasn't like a training sort of program. There was definitely some educational components, but they were more about educating ourselves on who we were. And it allowed me to pretty much establish and get through a lot of that pain. And it was a month long of really intense therapy. It allowed me to get through a lot of that pain that I was feeling and really embrace my choices that I was making. And at that point, you really don't have any choice but to take responsibility, ironically, you know, because you're now looking at and you're seeing, wow, these hands are actually shaping my life. But it was a very, very gentle program. It was very respectful. It was very dignified. There was the understanding that people that were there were only temporarily ill and they would be getting better and they were just like anybody else. And I think that was a really crucial part of that program.
In an article you wrote recently in the Times Colonist, an op-ed article called "Housing the Homeless is a Good Investment," you say the goal is also very simple. When people get housed, they get better. But you also remind readers, housing people doesn't necessarily erase the problems. What do you mean by this? And tell us more about that.
I mean, it's definitely not just a house. No, I want to be cautious because I want to say that housing first. In other words, the concept of going up to somebody on the street and giving them a set of keys and then supporting them to move into a place is very successful. It's a very wonderful program. To say that people still need support, often we interpret that or can be interpreted as we need to support these people and get them ready for housing. So we even have programs called Ready to Rent, for example. So there's this concept that when you're on the street, you're not ready. Obviously, people need support, but without an address, without a headquarters to operate from, it's impossible to move forward. But the concept that I see in the way Housing First works is you get a person into an address and then you apply the supports. So you've given the person the keys, you say, okay, do you want some help moving your stuff? You know, the person may feel they have some social anxiety, they may feel a lot of things. There may be some past trauma, there may be some addiction issues, but it's a lot easier if that person has a location that they're operating from that they feel is their own. It allows them to own their own experience.
So in other words, you're not suggesting that you hand people keys and then walk away.
Definitely not. I think what we need to do with the system in general is move the people from shelters and transitional programs into supportive housing positions. So the employees that work in the helping field, a lot of them are running around putting Band-Aids on things. What I'd like to see in the future is those outreach workers working with housed people, concrete, positive plans for their life. I think that's a way better use of resources and a way more compassionate thing to do as a society than to make eligibility requirements and decide that a certain part of the population is not eligible. I think that's counterproductive.
You wrote on your blog about the pros and cons of self-disclosure. So you find yourself in situations in which you can self-disclose or you may not. But you say that we survive by ending the silence. Tell us more about your experience of self-disclosure in the work that you do now.
I would say that I have survived in my own life by ending the silence. In other words, by sharing what happened, being able to face what happened, and I also help people in my community by ending the silence about what they're experiencing. So what that sometimes leads to is, you know, I'm in some meeting with leaders in the industry about homelessness and what we're going to do. And I might bring in a personal story. Well, I always found this. And it may seem to some people that that's unprofessional or that's an overshare. I have a little blog post on this. You know, I've got a little picture of overshare there. And I sometimes feel like that. I feel like I'm so willing to discuss it. And some people feel uncomfortable with that, but for the person with lived experience, our reason for sharing is survival, essentially, and improvement and working forward in the world. We can't fix this unless we look at it because homeless people are invisible, the cure is visibility, and the cure is speaking up. For me, that's what I find. Obviously, people need to disclose as they're comfortable, and there are disadvantages to over-disclosing. In some cases, there can be repercussions, but in general, I embrace the idea of sharing in my life, and that's part of my healing.
You've assisted in getting hundreds of homeless people into addictions or mental health treatment and hundreds more into affordable housing arrangement during the course of your career. Derek, what is it that all of these hundreds of people hold in common?
I would say they're like me, you know, and I think that's the mentality that we need to go forward with on homelessness. That is us. Those people that we think are somehow different are not so different. They're people who have experienced some pretty awful circumstances, but they are not, when given the chance, when given an opportunity, when people listen and when people come to understand them and connect with them, they just get better. That's what I find. You know, and I worked for about 12 years in this industry, and yeah, it's hundreds that I've seen, and, you know, so many different successes. But of course, and of course, as part of the team in, say, a shelter, you know, like I worked at Rock Bay Landing. It wasn't just me at Rock Bay Landing. It was so many hardworking, wonderful people watching these lives improve. You almost, once you start to really listen to a person, once the person really connects with you, it's like you just have to get out of the way because they have a natural plan for how they want to deal with this. So it's more of an honorable journey of watching somebody just get better just by connecting with them, just by hearing them, just by allowing them to share their story.
Derek Book, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Okay, thank you, Kevin.
Derek Book is a social worker and a tireless advocate for people experiencing homelessness. He blogs online at housecanada.blogspot.ca, and he's on Twitter at BookDerek.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.